I want to start this morning with a little contest, either on your outline sheet there or on a little separate sheet of paper. I'm holding a small bottle with sand in it, and I would like you to guess how many grains of sand are in this bottle. Okay, that's not a trick. This is real sand. That's what the bottle looks like. And so just go ahead and guess. And actually, the person who guesses the closest to what we think the estimate is, I've got a little gift card, a small coffee gift card to give you, okay? And if you guess within 500, when we have in February, we have a church anniversary every year. That's when we started our public services 21 years ago. We have a dinner. It'll be fun. I'll take a pie in the face if anybody guesses within 500, okay? And if you guess within 1,000, Pastor Jim will take a pie in the face. And we can't leave Pastor Scott out. So if you guess within 10,000, Pastor Scott will take a pie in the face. Okay, so write down how many grains of sand that you think are in this bottle right here without using your phone or tablet, any external help. Write that down, and we'll come back to that. We'll come back. Pardon? I know approximately how many grains of sand are in here. And I'll tell you how I know when we get to the appropriate time. But thank you for your question. We're going to look at all of Psalm 139 today as we wrap up this series in Psalms. It's our last Sunday in the Psalms. But two of the verses in this psalm are particularly appropriate as we think about this little contest. Verse 17 and 18. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Now let me show you how Psalm 139 is structured. There are kind of four parts and two parts. The first three parts, verses 1 to 6, 7 to 12, 13 to 18, all of those talk about an amazing God. They give us different aspects of how amazing our God is. And then verses 19 to 24, in the last few verses, it talks about responding to this God. So we talk first about how amazing God is, and then we respond to God. So let's look at three truths this morning, three amazing truths about an amazing God. And the first one is this: it's omniscience. Omniscience. God knows me completely. God knows me completely. Verses 1 to 6. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. This is David, the author of this psalm, saying this to God. You know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand on me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Now, what is omniscience? It's one of those doctrines We're going to talk about three of the doctrines in these three sections about God. Omniscience means God is all-knowing. That's what it means. Omni, all. Science, knowledge. God is all-knowing. Wayne Grudem defines omniscience as this: God fully knows himself and all things, actual and possible, in one simple and eternal act. That's a good definition of omniscience. God fully knows himself and all things, actual and possible, in one simple and eternal act. He is fully aware of everything at all times. If God wanted to tell us the exact number of grains in this bottle, O questioner, he could tell us the exact number without having to look it up, without having to Google it. God would know. He knows everything. He wouldn't have to remember it. It wouldn't be like, oh, I once knew that. What was it? No, he knows it all in one simple eternal act. David says, "You have searched me." That word means to examine or to investigate. In the Old Testament, it's used in investigating legal cases like Proverbs 18:17, and in seeking information about mining prospects, Job 28:3. It also refers to probing someone's character or feeling, like when Jonathan sounded out his father's feelings towards David. This is what God does. Jeremiah 17:10. I, the Lord, search the heart and examine the mind to reward a man according to his conduct, according to what his deeds deserve. You have searched me and you know me. Now, we use the word know in English in different ways. It can be a casual knowledge or it can be an intimate knowledge. And this original Hebrew word is much the same way. It can refer from everything from a knowing an acquaintance to knowing someone intimately. And the context of Psalm 139 is talking about an intimate knowledge. God knows us. And as we walk through this psalm, we're going to see how much God knows us. He gives some pairings back and forth in the next few verses that show us how extensive this knowledge is. You know when I sit and when I rise. You discern my going out and my lying down. And then in verse 5, you hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Let me ask you a question. Do you think David felt threatened by this truth or felt encouraged by this truth? I mean, hypothetically, the fact that God knows everything can encourage us, but it also can threaten us. It depends on what we're doing at that moment, right? I think David, at this point, is encouraged by this and is being comforted by it, because look at verse 6. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. So this is the first amazing truth that David prays about. God is omniscient. God knows everything, actual, everything possible, and he knows it in one simple eternal act. Secondly, God has omnipresence. And we would say, God surrounds me constantly. God is not just everywhere in some general sense. God is everywhere in the sense that he is with me right now. He is with you right now. Verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light for you. Let me give you a definition of omnipresence. God does not have size limitations or spatial limitations, and is present at every point of space with his whole being. Yet God acts differently in different places. And when the scriptures say God is present everywhere, sometimes it speaks of his presence to punish sin, and sometimes it speaks of his presence to bless. At other times it indicates that his presence is what sustains everything. Most often in the scripture, the times when you read this about God, it's about his presence to bless. Verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? You know, rhetorical questions assume an answer, right? And the answer that's assumed here is nowhere. Nowhere. And then he lists some places, the heavens, the depths, the wings of the dawn. That's probably a reference in his context of traveling as far east as possible, and the far side of the sea, probably a reference to going as far west. So I can go as far up, down, east or west, and I can't escape you. Verse 10. Even there, your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. It reminds me, we preached through the book of Jonah earlier in the fall, and Jonah was wanting to go the opposite direction that God told him to go. We wanted to go as far away as he could go. And in this case, this wasn't a good thing because Jonah was not obeying God. And so he was trying to escape. And yet he couldn't go far away from God, like to a different country or something. You ever play hide and seek when you were a kid? Hide and seek's a pretty fun game, but it's more heart throbbing when it's dark. When you're hiding in a dark closet or when you're hiding outside. But look at verse 11 and 12. Darkness isn't going to allow us to hide from God. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is this light for you. And again, I ask you, is this troubling or comforting? It may be a little bit of both. Are you prayerful? God surrounds you. Are you fearful? God surrounds you. Are you happy? God surrounds you. Are you nervous? God surrounds you. Are you sinful? God surrounds you. Are you walking with him? God surrounds you. David affirms, God is everywhere. There's nowhere that I can go away from you. Think about how amazing these truths are. God knows everything. He knows everything. He knows me completely. And God is everywhere. He surrounds me constantly. And there's one more. Creation. God formed me marvelously. God formed me marvelously. Verse 13. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Now, often when we talk about creation and the miracle of creation and the amazing truth of creation, we're talking about the amazing aspect of the size and the design and the intricacy of the universe. And all of that is appropriate because all of that is mind-blowing. When you think merely about the size of the universe that God has created, but Scripture goes beyond that and talks about how God knows and creates people. It's not just a vast cosmos that God has brought into being. God has brought you and me into being. Look what he says in my mother's womb, verse 13, and in the secret place, verse 15. God was not creating just life in general, but he was creating your life. David is believing that God created his specific life. Verse 16, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. God places tremendous values on us, even as embryos. God knew us in our mother's womb, and he sovereignly plans our days. Now, he also gives us freedom. But the emphasis here is on his sovereign goodness, oversight, and planning. I think it's probably safe to say that the human body is the most complex organism that we know about, right? Some of you particularly, I know, are in the medical field. And you would know better than the rest of us some of these intricacies. I think about engineering. Engineers, when they want to design these heavy things to hold heavy supports, they'll put the harder, stronger material on the outside and put lighter weight material on the inside. You're an engineer. Is that generally appropriate? One way of doing it. It's like God created our bones. They're hard on the outside and protective on the outside. And inside, all kind of blood is able to work through there. Sophisticated cameras can let in a certain amount of light or exclude a certain amount of light and can automatically focus on certain things, which is the way God made our eyes to do. It's an amazing thing. The human brain can reason and learn and control multiple functions at one time, like heart rate and blood pressure, while letting you stand or sit or keep your balance. The human body is an amazing thing, and God designed it. From one single fertilized cell, a baby grows, and all of the different kind of tissues and organs or systems are there. David says, your eyes saw my unformed body. Truly, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And so the psalmist shouts in verse 17, how precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. We heard recently in another psalm that God is both strong and loving. And once again, we see this. God is powerful. He's a creator. What a great, creative, powerful, amazing God. But what a great personal God who knows you and me, who knows our name, who's known us since we were in our mother's womb and has ordained all of our days for us. And we cannot even imagine how many thoughts he has towards us. As he thinks about it, he's like, David thinks of grains of sand. Think about how many grains of sand there in the universe. And he says, God, your thoughts are more than all the grains of sand. That's a lot of thoughts. Well, let's get an idea of how many thoughts that might be. So here's this little bottle. And in one teaspoon, there are 32,000 grains of sand on average. Just one teaspoon. In this particular bottle, and I do know this, there are 13 teaspoonfuls. So that means approximately 416,000 grains of sand in this little bottle right here. 416,000 grains of sand. Now let's start multiplying this out. This is one little bottle. 416,000. What about all of the horseshoe pits in the whole world? What about all of the beaches in the world and all of the sand on all of the beaches and ocean floors in the world? How many? Well, some researchers actually tried to figure that out. A science writer, David Blattner, in his book Spectrums, says a group of researchers at the University of Hawaii, I guess they were particularly interested in sand there, they tried to calculate the number of grains of sand on the earth. And they assumed, you know, a grain has an average size. And you can calculate how many are a teaspoon. And then you can multiply that times all the beaches and deserts in the world. And he said the earth, therefore, roughly, and it's very rough, has 7.5 times 10 to the 18th grains of sand, or 7 quintillion 500 quadrillion grains. And David says, if I were to count the thoughts that God has towards me, they would outnumber. Well, we got a little business to do here. 416,000. Got a little gift card here. Is anybody within 10,000? Scott nervously awaits. Anybody guess within 10,000? Really? What was your guess? 300,000? Sorry, that's... Yeah, it's 416. No, but maybe we should count. You think we should count it anyway? No, all right, so who... All right. So nobody's within 100,000. All right, Steve is within 116,000. Is anybody closer than Steve? Bobby, what did you have? Really? Okay. You're raising your hand back here. Are you closer? That's about 88, 12. That's 28,000. That's within 28,000. Can I verify? Can I see that written down? You didn't write it down. You told her. It's a conspiracy. They're working together. I know she is, but you... All right, I'll give it to you anyway. All right. Yeah, Bob Hancock. You almost got it, Scott. It's mind-boggling. God's a majestic God. This is the God that David is praying to. You're omniscient. You're omnipresent, God. And you're a marvelous creator. And so, as we're building our idea, that little part on your outline where we try to summarize the sermon in one sentence, let's start by saying, this is about seeing God's majesty. David is seeing God's majesty as he prays. He's praying about his knowledge. He's praying about his power. He's praying about his creative ability, not just in general, but how he created him. And now, we must ask the question, how do you respond to a God like that? How do you respond to such a God? In the last few verses, David responds to this God, and there are two responses. And the first one is to work against evil. Verses 19 to 22. If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. What a sudden switch in tone. We've gone from the sublime to this. And I'll be honest with you, when I first read these words, I thought, ooh, I wish that wasn't there. But as we reflect on it, maybe it's not out of place as much as it would seem. Let's think through some of this. Since God made the psalmist in his image, he made him a moral being. And as a moral being, you have a choice. You can either join in with God, or you can join in with God's enemies. That's our choices. It was a choice for the psalmist. To whom am I going to be committed? Am I going to be committed with God's enemies, or am I going to be committed to God? God has been amazingly good to him, and he asked God to remove the cause of evil in his world. And the truth is, here's the truth, even though this sounds on the surface a little bit disconcerting to us, we cannot be morally righteous and tolerate evil. We can't. You know, the last month here in America, the news about sexual harassment has gone crazy, hasn't it? And we've all seen the popular people, well-known people who, unfortunately, mistreated women sexually, and they're paying the price for it. And one of the questions is, when a major TV star has been doing it for years and years, one of the questions they want to ask is, who else knew about it? Right? Could it have been going on for a long period of time? And would people who knew about it, would we say they are righteous if they knew about it and they thought, oh, well, look, you know, we got good ratings. We got to overlook this, right? If that were the case, you'd say they aren't moral either. If I'm walking down the street, let's say I go to Concord Mills and it's down in the corner of a mall and there aren't people there at the moment, and I see a couple of guys and jump on a mother and a couple kids and they start robbing and beating them. If I go, oh, well, that's not my concern. I'm not moral, am I? Being right means that we have to not only love right, but we have to hate evil. And we have to work against evil in whatever form. Biblically, this is true biblically. The Bible says to fear God is to hate evil. And perhaps we don't understand that well enough. But let's think about how to understand these difficult words that the psalmist prayed. Remember this, just a few comments. First of all, this is a gut level heart reaction to God and evil. That's what this is. This is an honest prayer. This is not an endorsement by God of unloving action. We need to remember that this is a psalm. This is a prayer that's coming from someone's heart about evil. This is not God endorsing any action that is unloving. The subjects of this prayer are not somebody who just cheats on their income taxes, as bad as that is. These are bloodthirsty men. Hatred needs to be interpreted as incredible zeal for God, not necessarily spite. But even if he felt spite and communicated, look at the third thing. Look, this third truth, that these words lead David into praying some other words in verse 23 and 24. He wants to make sure that he's not being offensive, that his thoughts were in line with God's thoughts. And so he asked God to test his thoughts and to make sure he's on the right path. We'll look at those words again in a minute, but he is going to say, "Lord, search me and know my heart and make sure my thoughts are right." So it's okay to pray and to talk to God and tell God what's on our hearts without necessarily trying to filter everything. And in that same context, to say to God, "Now, God, you test me and make sure that I'm saying and praying the right things." You know, there are a lot of evils in our world today. There are a lot of evils. And one of our responses to a psalm like this, one of our responses to a God like this, is to work against evil. I could never, and I would never try to name every evil in the world. But let me name one that I think is particularly appropriate to this psalm, and ask us, just challenge us and challenge our thinking. Are we working against this evil in any way or in the right way? Let's talk about the sanctity of human life. Let's talk about the sanctity of human life. The taking of innocent life is evil. And we need to find ways to stop that. And we need to find ways to work positively for women who say, "You know, this was not a planned pregnancy necessarily, but I'm going to need help, and I want to see this child born, see this child cared for." And we need to find help for that. January 22nd, 1973 was a sad day in the history of America. It was Roe v. Wade. It passed. It prohibited all state laws, or repealed all state laws that prohibit abortion. 7 of the 9 Supreme Court justices ruled against what God says, that all human life is not sacred. And since that time, we don't know for exactly how many, but based on the estimates, maybe since 1973, more than 60 million babies have been aborted in our country. And verse 13 says, "You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb." Modern science has found some things out that David wouldn't have had any way of knowing. The heart starts beating at 22 days. The eyes begin developing by the 4th week. At 6 weeks, the baby begins to hiccup and to move spontaneously. And I want to tell you something. Some of you might be getting nervous, but I don't care at this moment. This is not a political issue. This is a moral issue. We're not into political issues in this church at all. We're not going to ever say vote Democrat or vote Republican or vote this person or this, that, and the other. But when there are moral issues, we're going to speak to them in our culture. And this is one of them. In 1983, President Ronald Reagan issued a proclamation. He established in January a National Sanctity of Life Sunday. And listen to what he said the following year when they celebrated the anniversary of that, a portion of his proclamation. Speaking of those who had been aborted, he said, "These children, at that time already more than 10 times the number of all Americans lost in all of our wars, will never laugh, never sing, never experience the joy of human love, nor will they strive to heal the sick or feed the poor or make peace among all nations. To diminish the value of one category of human life is to diminish us all. Slavery, which treated blacks as something less than human, to be bought and sold if convenient, cheapened human life and mocked our dedication to the freedom and equality of all men and women. Can we say that abortion, which treats the unborn as something less than human, to be destroyed if convenient, will be less corrosive to the values we hold dear?" Well, there's some great resources to work against evil. There's the Pregnancy Resource Center. here in Charlotte, a place of compassion and support and information for anyone who's facing an unintended pregnancy. There's abortionrecovery.org. And this ministry focuses on helping those who have had abortions in the past to learn how to deal with that and move forward. Our own youth group has been involved in Love Life Charlotte. They've taken prayer walks. What we love about that is they're not like raising big signs. Talking to Jim this morning, not raising big signs and screaming at anybody. And they're just prayer walking around places and trying to love people in that circumstance. And now churches are partnering with them, and some women are choosing to keep their babies, and churches are partnering with them and adopting those children. That's lovelifecharlotte.com. So we always want to protect life. We condemn any violence, any type of protest that would be violent, or any bombing and abortion, anything like that. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about godly responses to work against evil. And again, there are many evils in our world. I bring that one up because I think it's just so appropriate for Psalm 139. This is one way we need to respond to an amazing God, and that is to work against evil, because our God is a God of truth and light and justice. The second response is to open myself to Him. Look at verses 23 and 24. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Now, here, David's attack on evil, as it were, changes focuses. He's not thinking about the evil that's out there anymore. He's thinking about the evil that's in here. And we can't work against evil out there in the world apart from asking God, God, will you work on the evil that's in here? Will you search me? Will you know me? Will you test me? Now, he's already said in verse 1 that God has searched him and known him. Why ask God to do it? I think we enter an entirely new level with God when we cooperate with him, when we open ourselves fully up to him. He says, test me. This is what we do when we take our car to the mechanic. This is very familiar to me over the last few weeks. You know, kind of didn't want to start, and then it kind of didn't want to start, and then one morning it didn't start. In fact, one morning I took one of the cars, and my wife was left with that car at home, and it wouldn't start. And she called me. Somebody got her. After church, we go across the street to a place, and they test it. Oh, the battery's fine. Alternator's fine. You know, all this is fine. Because it started then. We were going to go home. Actually, we drove home, and I was going to jump it off with the jumper cables, and it started. But I could tell something was wrong. And I took it back to the place where I got the battery. The battery's still under warranty. They put a brand new battery in there. Sometimes it would start. Anyway, long story short, it finally, we believe, got resolved this week. I took it to my mechanic. I dropped it off and said, I'm going to drop this off, and I want you to keep the car overnight. And I want you to try to start the car in the morning after it has sat all this time. And sure enough, he found. It's what we do with a doctor when we know something's wrong in our body. We'll, okay, I'll submit to the test. David is saying this, God, I need a checkup. I need a checkup. And lead me in the way everlasting. Are you willing today to take your spiritual car, yourself, and pull into God's garage and say, okay, God, you run all the tests. You let me know what's wrong, and let's deal with it. Well, for us, It starts with seeing who God is. It starts with seeing God's majesty, just like David saw God's majesty. Let's finish that sentence. Seeing God's majesty changes how we see evil. Seeing God's majesty changes how we see evil. Psalm 139 is about seeing a great, awesome, amazing God and responding to Him. And David responded to Him by saying, let's take care of the evil in the world, and God, let's take care of the evil in me. What does that have to do with Jesus Christ? This is a Christian church. We are far removed from the days of Psalm 139, but this is so appropriate for what we have been talking about and singing about and reading about already this morning in this church service. And that is this: 2,000 years ago, the world was a very dark place. And it was full of a lot of evil. And it was empty of a lot of hope. And the Holy God of the universe decided to send His Son, Jesus, to come and be made flesh so that He could come and take care of evil. And that's what happened. That's what we celebrate at Christmas time. We celebrate Jesus coming, God the Father revealing Himself in the person of His Son, Jesus, in His incarnation, so that He could live and He could die and pay for our evil and take care of the evil in our hearts. That's the hope we have. You aren't going to take care of the evil in your heart by joining a church or being baptized or confirmed or trying to turn over a new leaf. But you can take care, or God can take care of the evil in your heart when you repent of your sins. You acknowledge, man, I'm sinful. I'm separated from God. Jesus, I know You died for me. Will You save me? That's how God takes care of the internal evil. And guess what? He didn't take care of all of the external evil when He was here. Because, as the quote that Nathan read in our time earlier, there's still a lot of evil in the world, and there's a lot of hurt in the world. But one day, when He comes the second time, He's going to take care of all evil. And He's going to make everything right. Praise His holy name. Let's bow our heads together, please.